jocks.
Starks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Jimmy on the board. Big down day yesterday in the market. This morning we are somewhat unchanged, down a little bit. Do we have Professor Lou?
Good morning, sir.
How are you, bud?
Let's see. Thirsty. It's very dry out here.
Yeah.
They're about, about to start water. They're about to start water restrictions.
They got record heat in Phoenix. They had to move spring training games from the afternoon to the evening. It's interesting world, eh?
Yeah, we're they're talking about us hitting 90 here on Saturday, which would shatter records. And you know, this wouldn't be such a big deal if we'd had any snow up in the mountains. But the snowpack there, I think they said the estimate now is they would need somewhere between 6.5 and 7.5 feet of snow in the mountain ranges west of Denver over. You know, the last month and a half of the snow season to put the snowpack back to an average level.
Yeah, I was reading YouTube on that.
Very dry.
You know, one thing I didn't understand was we're talking about if it's warm and you get rain, the rain doesn't do you any good because it evaporates off.
I mean, there's something to that. If it's And that's another issue with the high temperatures we've had this winter. The snowpack, you know, the air is so dry here that the snow literally evaporates. It doesn't really even melt. I think it's called transpiration is the effect, but the snow literally evaporates into the air. And when you get high temperatures or higher temperatures, that exacerbates it, obviously. So we've lost a ton of moisture, not just in the lack of snowfall, but in evaporation, and these high temperatures are gonna make it even worse.
Well, so, I don't remember all of my high school chemistry and physics, but most people think that snow or ice doesn't evaporate, but it does very slowly, but it does.
Yeah, and so it's going to be an issue here. As I said, they're going to start putting water restrictions in. I think next week, and I mean, so far it's going to be just mainly watering restrictions, but it could go much worse.
Well, Lake Powell's in real trouble.
Yeah, well, I think the whole Colorado River Basin's in trouble.
And it was making a pretty good comeback, and now the comeback seems to have been arrested, shall we say?
But you know, this area is drought prone. California is drought prone. The stupidity of water management across that part of the country is almost unlimited. No desalinization plants, no dams built in the last 20 years. No upgrades.
There's no water to dam up.
Yeah, there's plenty of water to dam up.
Not in the Colorado, isn't it?
Not this year, but there was plenty of water to dam up last year. And it runs off. They've lost huge amounts of runoff that could have been recovered. And
you're talking further up river. You're not talking about Hoover, Lake Mead or Lake Powell. I mean,
I'm talking down river toward the ocean. The dams, you know, the rainfall that came into California last year. You know, there was like a 90% runoff in the Northern California from the Northern California reservoirs. This is an ongoing problem there, and California specifically has refused to deal with it for a combination of environmental statutes and political reasons, ideological reasons, and so this is what's going to happen. So they're going to shut down. I assume agriculture is going to suffer first there. And then we'll see what happens from
well, the states
that
have
point
had,
forward.
What, 20 years or something to come up with a new agreement? The fact is that with all the people's rights to draw on the whole Colorado situation, the rights are higher than an average year. So, I actually spent some time on this. Plus, Bill Moriarty gave us a couple of days on this subject. the rights to draw off the Colorado for all reasons are from all the different states is higher than the average year.
Yes. The actual amount pulled out of the river, that's correct.
Yeah.
They base those numbers on unusually wet years.
Yeah, like in the 40s, the 50s.
I thought it was even
in the 20s. Yeah, it was back there.
And so it's a completely unrealistic. Those are completely unrealistic numbers. And again, based on population numbers that are completely wrong and unrealistic, along with agricultural use. So again, California is the big, you know, the biggest user, obviously, huge population, huge agricultural issues, or agricultural demands. And they have not since, I think, what, 65, maybe, was it 70, was the last time they did one of their dams. They haven't upgraded.
I know my conservative brethren love to pick on California, but the fact is Arizona gets a crap load of water from the Arizona River.
Arizona and the inland states have, you're exactly right, but California is unique among those states because of the basin states, because it has a coastline with the ocean, and it gets huge amounts of rainfall coming in. It's the first place rain comes in, and they're, you know, they get huge snowpack and runoff from the Sierras because the storms coming in from the Pacific dump most of their moisture right there. And California's in a unique position to exploit both the ocean with desalinization and rainwater.
They get enough rain to, if it was managed properly, they to cover essentially their needs. They're not that far away from it, but the reason why you have Mulholland Drive. Mulholland was the original guy who put all those runoff things and reservoirs in place back in like the 20s and 30s. The guy was a genius.
Yep.
And and they haven't done much more after that. But I know that when you see the fight about Colorado River, it's really a fight between the Phoenix suburbs and the Denver suburbs. I mean, people in the Midwest have no idea what all this is. I happen to have a few friends.
There's a lot of agricultural use in southern Colorado and Arizona.
But one of the reasons why Phoenix been able to grow so fast is they used to have. I've been going out there for a long time. I started going out there in the 80s, and
I'll be out there next week.
But they used to have, was it one big canal coming from?
Yeah,
not Lake Mead. What's the one below that? Lake Havasu.
Yes, I think that's right.
And I think somewhere or another in the last 15, 20 years they have two canals, which is one of the reasons why Phoenix has been growing more than some other areas, because they have the dam, the Teddy Roosevelt Dam, and I don't know what the story is here, Lou, but the Teddy Roosevelt Dam was built in the 20s or 30s to dam up the Salt River because there's runoff in Arizona as well.
Right.
And the idea was. There was never going to be a situation where you had to lose water from that dam, because if you drove through the Salt River in Phoenix, it was totally dry. You drive through the railroad bridges were sitting on dirt, and but every year, I won't say every year, I used to come for spring training every year. Every other year, the 100-year storm, there was water in the river because the dam, they totally miscalculated. And then. I think they said there's always going to be water in the river for boating and for recreational stuff. So people in the Midwest they have no concept that if water lands on your property in Arizona and you put a rain barrel under your gutter, you're liable to get fined because you don't own the water. Every drop belongs to the.
We have that situation.
What do they call it? It's the Salt River Reclamation Project from the 30s. Every drop of water is sort of accounted for.
Yes.
And when you see these golf courses where you'll see a golf course in Arizona that has mostly all grass, it looks like a Midwest course. Then you'll see a couple others where it's the target golf, where you hit to the fairway and then you hit to the green and the rest of it's all brown. It's all desert. Well, the ones that look like the ones here used to be a ranch like McCormick Ranch, those kinds of things, that actually had irrigation rights. The new places, they have to go get this huge permitting thing about how much water they can get and how many acres they can actually water. And that's why you have the target golf. If you go play Troon North, I mean, there'll be a fairway, but if you're off the fairway, you're in the sand, you kick it back in the grass, you're hitting three. It's, you know, it's interesting golf. You can hit from over there if you want, but you better have a club in your bag that you don't mind scraping up, because you hit one out of there and the bottom of the club looks like you hit it with a sandblaster. So everybody has like a trouble club in their bag from hitting off that crap. Because the desert is not sand. Everything's desert sand. It's not. It's like crushed stone, isn't it, out there?
No, it's, yeah. Anyway, it's rocky.
Just as a review of the elections and, you know, our alleged democracy, I went through this, stuff I dig up for you people. There's a site here where it tells you the amount of registered voters in every state and the percentage of people that are registered, of the amount of registered voters and what percentage of the population that is. You know, in Arkansas, there's only 1,470,000 registered voters, and it's only 65% of the population is registered. Seems kind of low, but that amount of people is. Anyway, Illinois, there's 6,000,007 that are registered, and that's 76.8. So if you do the math, that means there's 8.8 million people here that actually could vote. All right, so there's 6.7% that are 6.7 million that are registered, and we had roughly a 20% turnout. So if you look at the highest vote race in the state was for Durbin spot, and this lady Stratton won, was the lieutenant governor, and Pritzker spent zillions of dollars on negative ads for the other guy who I actually liked. I'm not too keen on this lady. Anyway, she gets 473,000 votes. You know, that's 5% of the population.
Yeah, that. Boy, that seems low.
That's how many votes she got, and I cannot understand why. I mean, I don't know. You can answer this question better than me, but they're having runoffs in Georgia. Virtually every spot here, every spot that was contested, it was a real race. Every person who won got way less than 50%. Some people got like 28%. And I don't get. And my brother, of course, is bitching at me yesterday because why am I complaining about this? The Senate race, there was this lady, there was Raja, there's Robin Kelly, and there's like seven other people. And first of all, it's a real pain in the ass to get on one of these ballots, how many signatures you need. There's got to be seven people there, Lou, that all have like 6,000 and 7,000 votes. I don't have a problem with them running. I don't have a problem with them getting their message out. But what are they doing, and who's voting for them?
Well,
where do they get the 7,000 votes from? Their neighborhood or what?
I was under the impression in Illinois, especially. I mean, it happens in other places too, but in Illinois, the parties, particularly one party, runs multiple stalking horse candidates to split the votes, so that because of your, you know, there's no rule that somebody has to have a majority of the votes, just gets the most votes. So that the preferred, you know, candidate, the party or the machine candidate is going to win.
Well, I mean,
you flood the ballot with phonies and divert votes, split the black vote, split the white vote, split the Polish vote, whatever.
There's been a history of that. To put like another black candidate.
I thought that was a regular practice there.
No, I'm talking about a string of just like seven people that just are there. I mean, Mike Quigley ran for pretty much unopposed, but actually there's five other people. But who do you get 2,000 or 3,000 votes from? I'm not talking about, you know, somebody who ran as an independent and actually got out. I mean, I never heard any of these people. Let me see if I can find a couple of them. There's like six or seven.
Were they legitimate campaigns or were they?
No, I never heard any of them until I saw the vote totals.
Oh, okay. I mean, one of my favorite guys who runs for, I think he runs for governor in New Hampshire all the time, is some guy named Vermin Supreme.
We're always getting a couple guys like that.
Who campaigns with a boot on his head.
Remember Lard Daly?
No.
Well, our America First Daily, where Trump stole his he was America First, and he'd get a sandwich sign, and he'd walk up and down Michigan Avenue, and he'd run for mayor every year. Or he'd run for senator or something. He'd get, but everybody knew him. He'd be interviewed all the time. He actually had some ideas, and he walked up and down Michigan Avenue. He was Lar Daily. He ran for everything.
Okay. So he was not a machine.
No. He just was a regular guy. He ran.
Okay. Well, I mean, again, Illinois was.
Well,
the
he
first
wasn't regular, but I wouldn't call him regular necessarily. But he was a guy that just ran.
Well, he was. I'm sorry. He was a regular candidate. He ran in every election. He wasn't picked by the machine to votes.
No, and he'd get on there and he'd bitch about Daley and the other people in office, and you know, there you go.
Well. I don't have a good explanation for why people don't get out. I mean, and vote. The normal assessments and things like this are that people are frustrated, or there's no reason, they don't care who wins because it's not going to change their lives. What were there any major issues? I mean, there should have been. Were there any major issues?
Well, either party, you know, it's interesting, Lou. I really don't like either one of it, and I guess I have my opinions, and people, you know, listen because they either want to argue with me or don't. But both of those are healthy, by the way. But I'm pretty good on focus groups. Here's what I'm talking about. This is for the Illinois Democrat Senate. So Juliana Stratton gets 478,000 votes. That's 40%. Raja gets 396. That's 33%. Robin Kelly gets 215. That's 18%.
These are all Democrats, right? In the primary.
Yeah, in the primary, yeah. But now there's Kevin Ryan. I mean, maybe he was big enough to at least have a commercial somewhere. He gets 58,000. But now there's Brian Maxwell, 9,500. He's got 0.8%. Sean Brown, 7,700. Awissi Bustos, 7,600. Christopher Swan, 74. All these people all get like 7,500 votes. Do they just get the votes in their small town or what? Jonathan Dean, 6,400 votes. Stephen Botsford, 5,085.
These were all running in the Democratic primary.
Yeah, yeah.
Is the total of the 5,000, 7,000 vote guys, would that have been sufficient to swing the results?
Well, if you include the 58,000, 58, 68, 75, 82, 89, 95, 100,000 votes went to these guys.
And that would have been enough to swing it if they'd voted for one of the two top vote
getters. But some of the people, and I don't want to go through all this list, but some of the people are in with 30% of the vote. There's that many people running. I mean, I think you ought to get 50% of the vote to win. It's just me. I mean, I do too.
And in a number of states, that's the rule. And I'm sure Illinois does not do that because that hobbles the machine, the Illinois machine politicians who
I don't know if
benefit
there's a
from
anymore.
Having, again, the kind of vote splitting that we just talked about, so that their candidate, even though they only get 30% of the vote, they'll win because they get the most votes.
Well, there was like two stages to the election. You know, and I guess, Lou, because I'm going to blame you and the rest of the people on this show. You've done this to me. Instead of just me looking at this and flipping the page and going to the baseball game, I actually study this because I know I have to be up on my game to joust with you guys. It looks to me like there were two different slots to this election, or two different waves. The first one was everybody getting money from somebody, everybody having focus groups, and telling people what they want to hear. Because everybody, Democrat, Republican alike, all the commercials, the first thing they said is, we're going to fight for you.
I
fought for something.
Yeah, fight this, fight that. Yeah.
What that tells me is there was 50 focus groups. Every focus group says, I don't know what the hell my person does. I never hear them. I never see them. I don't think they do squat. All the stuff's going on in Washington, and I never see him. I never hear him. I see the stuff that's going on. It all sucks. I never hear my guy speaking out against it. So obviously, that was heard loud and clear. So that was one of them. The other is nobody likes Trump. Okay, well that's one of them. Then it was the ICE people, and they're showing pictures of people doing stuff. And the third one was healthcare costs, or the fourth one. So those clearly were the four things that popped out of every focus group. Because if you watch, sometimes they were foolish enough to have four commercials right in a row, the exact same message in all four of them. Because everybody must have the same focus group. But then you see,
and no plan.
Well, what's the plan? I mean, what is a first year representative going to do?
Well, and that's what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're saying I'm gonna fix healthcare costs, my first question would be something in your commercial saying I'm gonna propose this.
No, you're talking about stacks and jacks where we actually go into the detail. The rest of the people don't want any part of the detail. So then the last 2 weeks, it absolutely flared into who had the most money, because you run nothing but negative ads on the other side. And this lady Stratton benefited by, like, you know, how many millions of dollars from Pritzker, which I absolutely abhor. I don't see why that's his, I get why he's doing it, but all the ads were, they must have run more focus groups saying, you don't want any part of ICE or the people with money. Everyone was, Raja took money from Trump's people that built the Bridgeport Detention Center, or something like, something you could never check, okay? And then they ran stuff about this Juliana Stratton. She took campaign money from this rich guy when she said she would. It was totally blatantly negative the last week, right in your face about who they took money from. And I don't think there's any way to check, really. Maybe there is a way, I don't know. But nothing that anybody... So whatever you believe bad about somebody, then you voted against the other person. And the combination of those two things, to be honest with you, sucks to me. It does. You're right. There wasn't an idea anyplace.
But unfortunately, we know that negative ads work. When your political choices are basically ineffective drones.
I don't know if they are or they aren't.
You're not going to vote for something. You're going to vote against something, and that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get you to vote against something. That's why Trump is so useful for the Democrats.
When I was doing this, I've said this before, but it's pretty important, I think. When I was doing my running for the board from the outside, they made us, the people who, the group of traitors said, look, we don't want you two guys looking like idiots, which we probably would have, and they sent us to this media training. And very interesting. Now, because I know what these guys are doing, but I also know they've taken it kind of to an extreme. And one of the things that was the most sobering, which would affect you in a second, by the way, is if you go into a room and you have a plan, like you say, if you say what you're going to do, if you meet, you have a fundraising, and there's 200 people there, and you go give a little speech, which people do all the time. Trump does, and Democrats do. People have been doing that since, Hector was a pup. And so you go in there, if you have a plan from Lou, it could be the most thought-out plan in the world, where everybody in there thinks that you're the smartest guy on earth and they agree with 90% of what you say, that doesn't guarantee a vote.
No.
They just like you. But if you say something like, I'm going to make sure that in the state of Illinois, nobody has two pensions, that's bullshit. There's going to be five people in that room that have two pensions that will never vote for you ever, 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 no matter what. And if they see in front of their car, they're going to hit the gas. So you can only... That's why nobody says that there's no plan, because every time there's a plan, guess what? Somebody's going to get hurt, right? Because everything we do now, people are getting too much money. I'm going to enforce this. Well, the people that are stealing there aren't going to vote for it. So it becomes just a total circle jerk, basically, because none of these guys, they're all coached so well that they're not going to say anything like that, because people respond negatively more than they do positively. Then only 5% vote. So
you want people. People will vote. You want to get your people voting against your opponent.
Well, you'd like to get them voting for you, but the fallback position is get them voting against the opponent.
Yep, I get it. That makes perfect sense.
Your buddy, our buddy John Najarian, Dr. J, was on his show with me forever. Still a good friend. We were having this. We used to fight on the air all the time, right? Discuss, whatever you want to call it. And one day he's talking about, we need to simplify the tax code. He's pounding his you know, up and down, up and down, up and down. We got all, we got people in the show now that want to simplify the task, go to value added. You know what? It's all BS, Lou, because wherever the people are that manage to get the current tax code leaning in their favor, be the same people who get the new one leaning in their favor. So Chad says to me one day, we shouldn't have, the tax code should be simpler. And I said, okay, Jan, so you don't think that when you and I go out to dinner, which we were doing every night because his wife was working late in a law firm, we'd bring her dinner and they'd go home. And I said, you don't think that, say, the dinner of the guy next to us in the restaurant, he shouldn't be able to deduct his because he says it's business when you and I are paying full price? He goes, well, yeah. I said, plus, you really don't want a tax code that allows people to deduct football tickets or skybox tickets when you and I are paying the same number. Well, yeah. So I'll tell you what. Here's your assignment. I'm the president. The restaurant show is in town this week. I want you to go over there and have, give a big speech about how you want to drop the deductibility of restaurant dinners. If you survive that, I want you to go to Roger Goodell's office and tell him how you think you're going to drop the deductibility of... It's a fight that nobody wants to fight because you don't get anywhere. All you do is get bloody.
Yeah, let's take it to its logical conclusion. We're going to eliminate the home mortgage deduction,
which we should.
Yeah, there's no reason for that.
But once you careful with that, because once you get involved in it, if you did it, and by the way, I agree with you, you can't do it this year. You have to say, next year it's 90%. The year after that it's 80%.
No, you have to phase it in.
Yeah, you can't just screw people who just bought a house yesterday.
Yeah, I mean that's. I agree with you, but these are the kinds of issues that make politics, and so. And this goes back to one of my favorite themes, which is the overreach of government regulation and statutory authority. The further that reach extends, the more likely you are going to have individuals engaging in what's called rent seeking, where they go to influence government policy because it has a direct economic effect on their livelihood or whatever.
That's what you're saying. That's
the
what
more
the law
government
is now.
Reaches in there, every government regulation, every government policy, every government program that affects things like how much water your toilet can flush and what light bulbs you can have in there, has somebody behind it who manufactures low volume toilets or high efficiency light bulbs.
Well, I think it would start from the idea. I mean, nobody wanted. I don't know if you guys where you grew up. In this area, with your electric bill, the Commonwealth Edison would give you 10 free bulbs a month. And of course, it was my job to go get, and you could bring like the last five bills and get like 50 bulbs. Everybody had a huge box in the basement of bulbs. They were the most inefficient pieces of shit that anybody, but guess what? It ran your electric bill to the sky. So the electric company says, we'll give you crummy bulbs that use all kinds of energy, and by the way, we'll charge you for the energy. How anybody was ever allowed to do that, Lou, I have no idea, but they did. And so then all of a sudden somebody gets an idea, hey, look, it, instead of, you know, not just the fossil fuels, but the amount, we're using way too much electricity than we need to. Why don't we make sure or make it easier for people to get bulbs that use half as much energy, and guess what? Maybe people's rates will go down, they won't use as much. There's some logic to it in the first place. Now, to jam it through and make it a requirement, and like Carl says, the first 80% of it's probably a good idea, the next 20% probably isn't because it's too hard to achieve. You know, getting your cars 80% less pollution was probably real easy. Getting the last 1% out of them is going to cost you $1 billion, and is it really worth it? You know, so you got that going for you, but if you and I were president, We could have a list between the two of us. How many blackboards, showing my age, could we fill up on stuff we wanted to do? But do we want to waste our first 6 months about, you know, deductibility of restaurant dinners? I mean, what a waste of 4 years in office, right? I mean, it comes down to what fights can you fight? And somehow or another, I mean, remember when the COVID was around and the well, not the first act where they sent everybody the checks. There was the Employee Retention Act. Remember that one we talked about?
Yes.
Where you Well, first of all, now PTI was considered a what was the word? Essential business. Now you would think that the essential businesses benefited more from the non-essential, but it was exactly the opposite. And you read laws all the time. I never do. But I decided I was going to read this one. Lou, I made it through a page and a half, and I said, oh, my God, a restaurant lobbyist wrote this thing. It was so obvious. And I don't know nothing about laws. If you were a non-essential business, if you were a restaurant, if you had a 100-person restaurant and a 5-stool bar, and the bar was closed because the things were too close together where you could spread people out in a restaurant, you were considered to be essentially shut down. There was no revenue test. There was nothing. Now, for PTI, we were totally shut down because of the riots. The building was boarded up. We were coming up the freight elevator. We were the only people in the building. If your revenue didn't drop 20%, and if the days that we couldn't get into the business, that my brother didn't have it worked out where he could actually take orders in his basement, if we were able to conduct business, we didn't count. Yet a restaurant who's serving 90% of the people their best year ever with carryouts, they were getting huge checks. I mean, who writes this stuff?
Well, people, so Senate staff or House staff who are subject to pressure every day from people who are donors. So the Restaurant Association mustered up a huge push to put in these crazy regulations. One of the really interesting things that jumped out at me that whole COVID exercise was just how dumb a lot of the people writing the regulations and the statutes were. And then, you know who Dave Portnoy is, right?
I've heard the name.
Barstool Sports.
Yep.
So Portnoy's gig, or one of his gigs, in addition to sports coverage and commentary, is pizza. He travels. He's got an app. I think it's called the One Bite app. But he travels around the country, rating pizza restaurants. He gets recommendations.
What a great job! He gets
recommendations from his people, and they go out and he films these three to five minute restaurant reviews, where he literally walks in, orders a pizza, takes it outside, takes a bite of it, maybe two, three bites of it, and then gives it a score.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've seen that guy. Okay.
Okay. So he's been all through Chicago and all this. So when this hits,
why can't he take a bite inside?
Because he wants the review outside, away from the restaurant people watching. So this guy in on his own recognizance, he realizes that exactly what you're talking about is happening with these dozens of small pizza places around the U.S. They are going under. Because they can't get loans, they don't have lobbyists, they don't have a lobbying organization. He sets up a GoFundMe or something like this, some kind of deal where he matches, and I guess he's fairly wealthy. He matches every dollar that comes into this fund account, and he, as he goes around and finds these little restaurants, he gives them money. He gives them like $60,000, $100,000 straight up. No questions asked, infusion of cash, the donation to keep them up and running. And he does that over the course of COVID.
Lou, I see, what does Schultz say? I see nothing, I know nothing. I'll tell you this, several of these places that I know of. Now, you had to be kind of big enough. One of the places I knew, for some reason, people love to talk to me. I don't know why, because I like people. The owner, who I don't know from Adam, I talked to him 2-3 times. Audrey and I sitting there having a glass of wine. They had their best year ever during COVID on carryout for a while when the place was totally closed. Then when they were able to have a certain amount of tables inside. Said I had my best year ever, and I got two $350,000 checks to the government.
Yeah,
because the bar was closed down.
Yep. Well, a lot of these places, a lot of the pizza places were not getting this. And again, to his credit, and whatever else you want to say about the guy, he's rough around the edges, but I think he's a legitimate and authentic. to his credit, he did not film any of this. You know, he films all of his pizza reviews. He did not film any of the stuff, as far as I know, relating to handing out these loans. He just went in, you know, if the place he found out he liked the pizza, he found out the place was in trouble, he would get them on his list.
Because, I mean, if you had any, the places that got totally screwed are places in the city that had no sidewalk in front of them.
Yeah.
The place in the suburbs, for God's sake, there's one place in Burr Ridge, we'll go nameless. The suburb mayors were much more conducive to let people do stuff. They just said, take half the parking lot and put picnic tables out there. You know, because people still wanted to go out. Well, this place put up a, what do you call it, kind of like a hard-sided tent. It used to be called Butler Buildings, but it wasn't that strong. But anyway, the guy puts his tent out in a parking lot and puts carpet on the asphalt. The place, the tent was, it had to be three times as big as his restaurant.
As his restaurant. And no, everybody's of course, inside.
But then, yeah. But then inside, he spread the tables, you know, 8 feet apart or some crap, which he had to do the second iteration. Allegedly, the bar was closed, but it was ass to elbow in the bar. It didn't look closed to me. That dude, I can't imagine how much money he made, Lou. And he probably said the bar was closed, and he probably got a half. Ditka's joint in Ditka's place, it never closed, and he got two checks for $325,000 or something down in Oak Brook. You get paid for your entire wages from people.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the Iran situation.
We're switching gears.
Well, without getting into the God knows what everybody's doing over there, but we had a little bit of a debate. Matter of fact, I ran into a MAGA guy last night who was kind of a pain in the ass, but mainly because really didn't have any. I asked him. I did some stuff on the Gerald Ford. They had the fire under Gerald Ford, right?
The laundry fire, yeah.
Yeah, and Hal was on yesterday, and Hal was in the Navy, was in the Persian Gulf. And I said, okay, what happens if you're at sea longer than you thought? And he says, well, you end up deferring some maintenance because there's a reason why you're going to port all the time because stuff, you know. And the Gerald Ford, this is their first soiree out, whatever you call it.
Yeah, their first operational cruise.
And they're pushing 240 days with no end in sight. And normally it's 6 months, which would be 180 days. And, you know, there's a problem there with, evidently, Lou, they were in the Mediterranean originally. Then they were sent to Venezuela for all the stuff that was going down there. And then back to the Mediterranean, and then through the Suez Canal, which I guess it's designed to do, but it's never really anticipated. The thing, you know, it's you know, 2 feet away from the sides of some of the channels or something. I don't know. So now it's somewhere else, and it's doing these things every day. And there's 4,500 people on the thing. And like Hal said, a lint fire is exactly what you would expect because that's something that when it comes into port and you tear the thing apart, you do all that. You clean all those things out, the elevators. He goes, he was on a nuclear, wasn't really a cruiser size. It must have been a small cruiser. And he said, we would start to defer stuff the last month or so if we were kept out after. He goes, you don't have the parts. You don't end up port. He goes, no matter what you do, the stuff starts to degrade. This guy last night, of course, is all over. Why don't you sign up? You do what they tell you to do. You never complain. I said, I'm not saying the guys are going to mutiny. What I'm saying
is... No, this is not... This is exactly why a shortage of ships is a problem.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's why you want a certain number, because you have to... A third at sea, a third in training, and or getting ready to go to sea, and a third in port for repairs.
You know, it used to be... 15 years ago, it was 25, 25, 25, 25. When we had 16 carriers. We had four out, four totally taken apart, four being put back together, and four, and, you know, getting ready to go out. And now we're down to 10, so all that does is make, if you still want the four of them out there, you're down to what? 10 months you're out there, right?
Or, because the bad guys don't really pay attention to our or don't really accommodate our maintenance and training schedules.
But who were the geniuses that said, we don't want 16 anymore, we can roll with 10 as long as they're big enough?
So if you follow some of the guys that I follow, that have Navy guys who have been screaming about this for the last 25 years, I mean, that's how long it's been going.
By the way, I have too, ever since I read this article. Must have been 25
yeah.
years ago.
Yeah. The failure of our failure to keep our shipbuilding operations in place, our failure to keep our maintenance yards up to speed, our failure to anticipate. I think this goes directly to Navy leadership. I blame a focus on things other than shipborne readiness that overcame the Navy. The Navy's BUORD, or I think this is the acronym of shipbuilding, has been a disaster. It's classic bureaucratic idiocy.
I remember that from the Winds of War, BUORD and BU ships.
Yeah.
BU ships and makes the ships, and BUORD does the ordnance and all the other stuff.
He does the ordnance. And so their Bureau of Shipbuilding has, you know, they were supposed to trot out, we were supposed to have a destroyer class called the Constellation class that was supposed to be rolling out, you know, I don't know, now. They spent 15 years on this thing and no boat got built. We were supposed to have a class of 30 Zumwalt high-tech destroyers that were gonna, you know, were basically stealthy and had all kinds of, you know, rail guns and all this other stuff on it. We built, what, three of them?
And we got these literal ships, littoral ships.
Yeah, the littoral ships.
That's a ship looking for a mission. Doesn't that do anything?
Right. Well, I mean, they were talking about using them as minesweepers, but I don't think that's going to fall apart. But no, we didn't build any minesweepers, Chief. We didn't build any icebreakers. We didn't build, I mean, any of the stuff that we were supposed to have. This is one of the reasons why, you know, the battleship that got proposed, I think late last year, the Trump class battleship. The immediate reaction of the Navy brass, the ones that hadn't been fired yet and should be fired, was, you know, this is ridiculous. We got rid of battleships for a reason after the Second World War. And I'm thinking, well, in the Gulf right now, it would really be nice to have a floating gun platform and missile platform.
Without a doubt.
That could sit in the middle of the Gulf, defend itself, and by the way, extend a bubble 50 or 60 miles out in all directions for shooting down anything that comes into it. It'd be nice to have a ship.
I'd be right with you.
We don't. The old ones
were so people intensive, but doesn't mean you can't do something different. But why, Lou, we're spending the dough. Why is it we have no? Is it somebody's inability to make a decision? I think we have smart people. I think defining. I mean, two things here that are bizarre to me, and it's little stuff, and it's not all on Trump because it's been going on for 20 years, like you say, maybe more. I mean, you and I have been talking about this drone stuff forever, and I don't know anything about it. You do, but we had to go get people from Ukraine to teach us how to stop the drones for less money. Because they've figured out ways to do it, you know we had eight.
Well, we have guys here who were developing that, who developed that technology, and were spinning it up on their own, you know, with no defense contracts. And so that, I mean, there's a very well developed drone group and drone technology here that is perfectly capable of operating. And are in many cases working on manufacturing these drones that Ukraine's dealing with, so it's not like we didn't have people paying attention to it. What we had were people at the top who didn't want to buy cheap weapon systems, and that's part of it. They want the gold plated stuff.
Well, could be. I mean, I don't know. I know nothing about airplanes. You're the Air Force guy, but it seems to me the airplane that everybody keeps wanting to get rid of, the Warthog, if you had three or four of those things, you could send a whole bunch of drones in them. They got all those cannons. They'd take them all out.
Well, the Warthog is not a... I mean, it's being used in an air-to-air role, but it's not really an effective air-to-air.
But I'm saying
platform.
They have the cannon could have little grenades on them or something, something way low-tech.
The most effective anti-drone thing that the A-10 carries, and they're putting these on helicopters now too, is a laser-guided dumb rocket that they managed to retrofit with a very cheap laser guidance system. And these rockets are, you know, I won't say dime a dozen, but they're relatively inexpensive. And let me put it this way: they're cheaper to make than the drones are. So firing one of these things is a dead on kill at the slow moving drones that are over there. And so the Warthog is really good with that, and it's useful for that. But the 30 millimeter cannon is not. There's only I think they only carry 1,000 rounds in there, and it you know, it's like 15 or 20 seconds worth of fire.
I'm saying my point was it's something more lower tech, but this is the part that, and you're touching on it here. Somehow or another, maybe because I kicked up YouTube and looking for something about baseball, and I ended up with a whole bunch of things. You and I talked about the place in Wisconsin that makes the minesweepers and how they got cut from 4 to 2 or something last year.
Yeah.
And well, turns out we have 8 of the old wooden minesweepers left. 4 in the Middle East, 4 are in Japan for whatever God knows reason. The 4 in the Middle East, like 2 or 3 months before this happened, are decommissioned.
Yep.
And they're brought home on this. You ever see that ship that they bring other ships
yep.
home with?
Yep.
What a thing is
I
huge.
Saw that video.
Yeah, what is that ship? So the 4 things are sitting right in there. Instead of telling the guy, turn around and go back, they don't. And evidently there's a couple of the literal ones you're talking about, littoral ones, that are supposed to be the next generation. I just got a X feed from one of the listeners. They were spotted in Australia. What in the God's name do we need a minesweeper in Australia for?
Well, the minesweepers in the Far East are there for Taiwan.
Okay.
And because we believe that one of the things that China will do is blockade Taiwan, and one of the ways they'll blockade it is they'll put mines around the island. But again, minesweepers are not sexy.
No.
Minesweepers don't shoot things. We have a crew issue. You have to crew those things. You have to pay for them to crew them.
You know, who's a crew on a minesweeper? The guy that comes after you, Wayne. He said they took the minesweeper back across the Atlantic. He goes, that was a ride. Evidently, those things weren't designed to head from where the hell he come from, Britain to New York or something. He goes, they hit a storm. He goes, that was kind of easy. He goes, even the captain was puking.
Yeah. My point is that this kind of basic logistic stuff, and in some cases, it's a choice between bullets and minesweepers. And if you've got your high tech stuff, your destroyers and light cruisers that are firing, $1 million missiles at targets, and they're burning through those things, your budget guy comes to you and said, "We need more money. We can buy a minesweeper, or we can buy 150, 200 of these missiles." You say, "Buy the missiles because we're burning them up." Yep. And the minesweeper thing we'll worry about later, and that's what happens.
Well,
we need operational funding to keep a boat at sea versus money for repair and shipbuilding. Okay, the boats at sea.
What is the background though? And this is I sort of sense this at every, I don't know if it's lack of education, whatever it is. I sense this kind of at every area you talk to people about whatever the policy is. I mean, last night, this MAGA guy, all he kept doing was putting his hands over his ears and talking about how what Trump was raging about yesterday, that we sent all this money, cash, over to Iran. And I said, well, do you have any idea why we did that? Not only didn't know, he didn't want to hear it. And I said, do you know why we sent cash? I said, I'm not saying I agree with it, but do you at least know the reason? Didn't want to hear that either. But now, World War II, I was reading this stuff about why our aircraft carriers and our ships were so much better than Japanese in terms of damage control, fire control, all those kinds of things. And that was really the reason why early on, you know, we hung in there and they didn't. I mean, if they'd had the same fire control mechanisms and procedures at the Battle of Midway, all 4 of their carriers wouldn't have gone down. You know, but they had hoses that were no good laying on the deck, all those kinds of things. In the summary, this guy's summary was people like Nimitz and all the people around him, had been engineers in previous, like, not necessarily in previous lives, but they all had that sort of training, and were all very concerned about sustainability and fire control and things like that. That's just the way they were brought up. So it wasn't like they just thought about it as an afterthought. They were obsessed with it because that's the way.
So do you know what degree you graduate with from a service academy?
It's got to be some kind of engineering, I would think.
It's Bachelor of Science. Okay. Every graduate from a service academy comes out, and it doesn't matter. I was a Russian Area Studies major at Air Force, but I graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree, and you know why? Because I had 8 semesters of math. I had electrical, aeronautical, astronautical, civil, and mechanical engineering courses jammed down my throat. I had all that stuff. And at West Point, when I got my appointment to West Point, one of the reasons I didn't go is because I was going to be forced to be an engineering major.
It's supposed to be the best engineering school in the country.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, Air Force is one of the best aeronautical engineering and astronautical engineering programs. I mean,
well, I would hope.
Yeah. But everyone of these guys that you're talking about, that senior level, because Annapolis and West Point were very heavily represented at the top ranks, every one of those guys had engineering jammed down his throat. Every one of them. And they understood you understand the basic principles of, okay, this can go wrong in this way. This can go wrong in this way. This kind of a system is going to fail if we do this to it. That permeated, and I think it to a certain extent still does, permeated the basic education of our leadership. And I don't know if that's the case anymore.
Somewhere along the line, you got to stop talking about it. You got to pop out with a ship. What if I just talked about a trade all day and never did one?
Yep. And that's what has happened with the Navy. To a certain extent, that was what was happening with the Air Force, although the Air Force leadership has been screaming for probably the last decade and a half that its fighter force is so, and its support force is so old that they can't really sustain those aircraft much longer. I mean, those two airplanes, those two KC-135s that ran into each other, where they lost the six crew members, those airplanes were over 60 years old.
They were the original prototype of the 707.
Yeah, they were actually the variation was referred. They were actually referred to, or Boeing referred to them as the 717.
Yeah, because they're not as wide as the 707 ended up being.
Yeah, so. Those airplanes are 60 years old. I mean, I flew in a B-52 in the middle 70s. That was older than I was.
Well, but
in 1975.
What part of the plane on it isn't new, though?
I'm sorry?
What part of the plane isn't new, though? I mean,
oh, well, the struts, the airframe, the engines are new, but the B-52's flying with, I think, 10 or 11 miles of wiring that's inoperable, you know, because they left the wires in there when they just replaced equipment.
Really?
Again, those airplanes are still flying. Now, a lot of them have been engineered, they've been re-engineering on them. But just to give you an indication of what it was like flying on that aircraft in 1975, we were flying a low-level night mission. I was a cadet at the academy. I'm in the jump seat watching the pilot, co-pilot. We're flying at 500 feet in the dark over Maine. So it is pitch black. There are very few lights for reference, and we are using a very early variation of low-light TV and a terrain-following system that basically put a line on an oscilloscope that represented the ground, and you needed to keep that line below a certain point on the oscilloscope, or you're going to hit the ground. And so we're flying along.
God, how loud was that thing for people on the ground?
I'm sorry?
How loud would it have been for somebody on the ground, that thing?
Well, there was nobody on the ground. We were flying over, when I say it was pitch black, there were no lights.
Okay.
We're flying over northern Maine. And we're cruising along, and all of a sudden the illumination of the cockpit goes blink, and everything goes dark.
God.
It's like a fuse blew or something. And the AC goes, oh, it's that cable connector. Hand me a juice can. So the box lunches came with that crappy little cans of orange juice. You remember that stuff? That you know, had an early pop top on it.
Okay.
And so the cans are like, they're like 3 5-ounce cans or something like that. They're tiny. So we'd eaten our box lunches. So the co-pilot reaches over, grabs one of these little cans and hands it. And the AC, we're flying along and you know, we start to gain altitude because we weren't really sure exactly where we were. We had a radar altimeter, but it was giving us a variation of or a variable readout. He takes the can and he crimps it and crushes it and puts it, you know, squeezes it in half. And then he sticks it in behind this console and wedges it under one of the CRTs, one of the cathode ray tubes, because apparently there's a bad cable connector there. And when they're flying low level and vibrating, it vibrates loose. So he jams this juice can in under the CRT to push it up, and that reconnects the cable, and all the lights come back on.
Good for him.
This was, and apparently this was a well-established procedure by the crews to deal with this cabling issue. And I'm going, you got to be kidding me. This is a nuclear-capable bomber. This is one of our weapon systems. And this thing gets repaired with a juice can. So that was 1975.
Now it's 50 years later.
Yeah. What do you think those bombers look like now?
I don't know. I thought they were pretty much all redone a bunch of times, but
not when you step inside them. They look old.
Do those things have a bathroom?
It's called a honey bucket.
Oh. So, oh God. You know, the thing of it is, Lou, the money. That's one of the things about, you know, that I. When everybody talks about efficiency, and then once in a while I come up with something and says, well, you know, it's like the CTA. They went from having a guy in the middle that took care of the doors and kind of could watch what was going on, and he had a driver that didn't have those responsibilities, a motorman, not a driver. And all of a sudden, you get rid of the guy in the middle for costs. Okay, you got much more trouble in the CTA, and the fares are twice as much as when you had the guy.
Yep.
So what exactly did you accomplish? I mean, it's not like the budget for the Air Force isn't any less. What are we spending it on? Now, this guy, last night, his son's just graduated Air Force Academy, and evidently nice. Well, when I was at Notre Dame, because these guys used to borrow my car, the guys at Air Force ROTC would go out to South Bend Airport, and they would take their initial flying lessons if they were going to be a pilot. Well, now this guy graduated from Air Force Academy, goes on like break, goes somewhere else. Now he's down where's the jet place down in Florida? And he's going to be 2 months full-time taking his first flight training in a Piper Cub or a Cessna, getting his regular rating like I would go get, and his instrument rating. Why the hell didn't they do that in the 4 years he was at the Air Force?
They actually do have a flight orientation program at the Academy that gives all the cadets flight time in sailplanes, and I think if you're a pilot track
I think it's all gone.
Well, the sailplane program is not all gone, okay, because I was down there. I see them flying every day.
Okay.
The Cessna program is still there. They still have some kind of, it's called T-41, and they still have that. But it's limited, and it's budget, Tom. I mean,
but it's got to cost more to put the guy up in Florida for 3 months than just do it right there.
No, they however they allocate the money, whatever pot that money is in, it's cheaper to do that than it is to do it at the Academy. And that's, I mean, they do have flight training there, but it's not like getting your pilot wings kind of flight training.
Hey, before we go to the other dudes, what is your feel on Middle East vis-a-vis inflation markets, those kinds of things? You must have an opinion.
I think it's going to be, you know, some short-term pain. and I'm all in favor of doing what we're doing to Iran and taking it down. There may be some. I read a really interesting article last night by one of my ship guys that I follow that said, you know, this may not be about Iran as much as it might be about the Straits of Hormuz. And our decision at a grand strategy level to basically say we are going to take control of that area because it's totally crazy, and we're gonna enforce, you know, what he was saying was we could open the Straits of Hormuz tomorrow if we wanted to. We have the resources. We're just not doing it.
Well, we have. Well, let's kick it around next week, because this idea that we need to do all this stuff, maybe we needed to do it when we were importing 50% of our oil. It's hard for me to understand why this was imminent three weeks ago when we have all the oil we want.
I think that may be the reason that maybe, according to this guy, that's a factor in why we're doing it.
Well, I...
Pay attention, by the way, one last thing. Pay attention to fertilizer.
Oh,
planting season starts in, I think, 2 weeks.
I am. We're going to talk about that probably tomorrow. But
with that, I'll leave.
Do we have our guys?
Yes. Good morning.
All right. Hey, how are you?
Good morning.
What's good about it? Market's down 32, NASDAQ futures down 163. Gold's down 190 bucks. Everything's down. Bitcoin's down. You name it, everything's down. The only thing that are up are puts. Hey, I have a question for you guys, but I don't know of who else would know the answer. I was saddled, well, it was a discussion with a MAGA guy last night, and all I kept talking about was how we sent, listening to President whatever yesterday, talk about, you know, the money that went sent to Iran, which has nothing to do with what he's doing, I don't think. It was a long time. I mean, you might as well rail about Eisenhower kicking the legitimate governor out in 54. I mean, what does that get you? I don't know what it gets you. But of course, the guy wanted to hear nothing about why we sent him money and why we had to send him cash. Nobody wants any level of detail. You listen to the line of crap coming out of Trump's mouth, and somehow or another you think it's gospel. But
yeah.
My question on this, I mean, Fari, I suppose I could get him back on to talk about it. Fari's dad was one of the top two or three Air Force guys under the Shah. And matter of fact, like the last plane out was Fari's family and his dad, I think. So Fari knows a lot about this crap. And for those that don't know, the reason why, and I'm not saying I agree with what they did, but the reason why Iran felt they were owed that money. Now, Iran, now that's another story. It's a different government. You know, it wasn't the Shah anymore. It was this new goofball, it was the Ayatollah. And there has been history of people who came in and are a new government. In other words, Mexico does not feel that they need to pay anybody who has a Santa Ana or a Maximilian bearer bond. They just say, screw it. That wasn't me. Now, Germany, Hitler, and people after him feel no obligation if you have a bearer bond, gold-backed bearer bond, sold in this country in 1928 to pay you back. So there is precedent for not paying the second regime the money. But now, the U.S., we would be very concerned, I think, if somebody borrowed money from us under Clinton, and now we're under Trump and saying, well, Trump's not Clinton. I don't know you. I mean, we would have a problem with that. So what happened, I believe, and you guys, I think, can fill in the blanks, is the Shah ordered all kinds of military equipment, F-14s. There was a couple of, mine, I think it might have been a minesweeper. There was a couple of destroyers, and they sent over essentially progress payments to various places. Whoever makes the F-14, whoever made these ships, so the money came over here to essentially start the construction. The construction was almost done, so they had paid for a lot of this stuff already. The Shah gets tossed out, and we say we're not delivering it, and we didn't. And Fari said a couple of the F-14s were already at the dock in Baltimore, and actually were there like a couple of years before the Air Force came and collected them because they were still ready to go overseas. Now, my question is, that money came here. Now, did it go to whoever makes the F-14 and the ships, I'll say the McDonnell Douglases of the world, did it go to them and they kept it. And then when Obama decided to pay him back, did we, meaning you and me and the rest of us, pay him back with the cash, or did he pick up the phone and say, hello, Boeing, we need the cash back? I'm guessing he didn't do that. Do you have any idea how that went down?
What I know about that is the money at some point in time went into probably the U.S. Treasury Department maintained some sort of escrow account.
But why? Because those guys actually built the stuff, so they were using the money to build it. Wasn't it just a regular construction progress payment?
Oh yeah. I mean, I know when I worked at RCA, we had RCA engineers over there under the shop installing all kinds of signals intelligence stations to monitor regional communications and Soviet communications. But the money they say Obama gave, I mean, it's just this is demagoguery, but it was frozen Iranian money, and it also there was money that Iran had tied up in some of our financial systems, all of which was frozen. So what Obama did was unfreeze it, he didn't give it all back to him, but it was to get them moving on negotiating this JCPOA, the nuclear agreement. And of course, the other day, the chief Iranian negotiator, who I remember when he was Secretary of State, John Kerry, said he found this guy Ali Larijani as somebody he could deal with, and he thought he had a reasonable relationship with him, and now the Israelis, I guess, killed him the other day and some sort of dropped a bomb where he was hiding out. So yeah, it's a mess, and the people that say Obama gave him this money, it's you're right, it was their money, and it was just a signal, look, let's start negotiating.
Well, the reason why they had to give him cash was because they literally can't cash a check. They've been taken out of the whatever the system is where different countries
can wire. They were cut off from the SWIFT system and everything. Yeah.
Well, Andrew, what do you make of all this? I mean, where does this all? I mean, this every week this drags on, and then we had the huge jump in PPI yesterday, and the president comes out 30 seconds later and says there is no inflation. Well, duh. Where do you think this all lands? We had just an election in Illinois, and I went through the numbers earlier. I don't think you were listening. It turns out that like 5% of the people vote for these people, and half of them don't even get 50%, and they're still in. And doesn't seem to have rousted any voters out of their house. I mean, what are you making of this whole mess?
Well, of course. I mean, starting with your most recent point first here on the elections, it's mostly in Illinois primaries. So you're not necessarily going to have big campaigns on recent developments or any indication that a vote's going to make a difference. But on these kind of issues, because it just happened and it's within the parties. One thing I think is interesting from afar is my perception is that a lot of the big money people, a lot of the dark money people that wanted to influence these primary elections in Illinois, they came up kind of short, which I think is a good thing. I think it's to the extent that I'm accurate about that.
Why do you say that? Pritzker ponied up $4 or $5 million for this lady's negative campaign in the last week, and she won. It looks like he did okay.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that that's dark money. We know where it comes from, and in our system, that's some degree of accountability. But one of the congressmen that Stratton defeated, and I should know how to pronounce the name.
Raja something something.
Krishnamurti.
Yeah, I actually met him several times, but it's a tongue twister early in the morning here. He was getting, a lot of these guys were getting big bucks from the crypto interests, and Jesse Jackson Jr. was also, and he lost.
Yeah.
And then AIPAC was heavily invested in some of these elections, and their candidates didn't do that well, except Melissa Bean prevailed. But there's a lot of money floating out there in those primaries. I don't think that much of it had to do with current developments, for obvious reasons, but I think the voters, in their infinite wisdom, disregarded the ads that some of the big dark money folks were putting in. Now, as you point out, Pritzker did contribute from his stash, but we know more about that.
There were two waves, and I don't expect you guys to be sitting trying to get your car fixed watching one of these after another, but there were kind of two waves. The first wave was all just focus group, what are you going to tell people? And if you listen to four or five up in a row, they were all the same. I'm going to fight, because evidently people must think their current people are lazy. They're going to fight against Obama, they're going to get rid of ICE, and they're going to cut medical costs. And everybody not only was going to do, they all fought against medical costs. I haven't seen anything happen to medical costs. And the Republican guys come on, and one of the ladies is, she fought against China. And I'm thinking, what'd she do? Argue her bill at the Chinese restaurant? I mean, what did she do? I mean, I have no idea. What does it mean? I fought against this. Where?
She was heavily invested in paper plates.
Yeah. So then the last 2 weeks, it totally turned into something. Raja took money from this person, that person. And then, of course, then it's Juliana Stratton who ended up winning. She took money from this person who also built the thing in Broadview that they're holding people in, is the same guy who built the place. The second week, the last week, was all negative on something maybe only you guys could even check out. But it was totally useless, except for everybody was an ass, basically, and a crook. And I don't know what that does, but something, I guess. I don't know how you come back from that, but evidently you're going to try to. It just was weird.
Well, I had in the spirit of full disclosure, I can't, and we're talking about last names. The young reporter named Kat and Abu Ghazala, who was running, I guess it was Schakowsky's seat. The only reason I gave her some money is I saw these ice guys picked her up. She's just a little tiny gal, 26 years old, and threw her across like a parking lot.
Yeah.
She, you know, and I actually could feel that. I mean, I said, oh my God. She came close, but she didn't quite. Mayor.
I'm going through it.
Evanston.
Yeah, the mayor of Evanston.
A guy named Biss, yeah.
But now, how many states, why does this trouble me? Melissa Bean, who I actually had talked to a few years ago when she was first in there, she only got 31% of the vote. How do we not have runoffs here? There's all kinds of people that run for these things. I mean, here's like a bunch of guys. Here's a guy, in this particular one, this is the House 7th District. Wait, 8th District. Melissa Bean, she gets 21,000 votes. All right, Junyad Ahmed. Boy, I'm getting like you here, Andrew. I'm trying to pronounce these names. She gets 18,000. A guy named Dan Tully gets 8,500. Yasmin Bankhole, whatever the hell kind of name that is, 6,400. Neil Knott gets 4,500. Sanjot Dunning gets 1,600. How the hell do you get in with 31% of the vote?
Well, the great, and I truly mean it, Abraham Lincoln only got 39% of the vote when he won the presidency. And in fact, I've looked it up. He won only four or five counties in what's now regarded as the South out of 900 because he was running against three other people. So you can adjust state laws or on elections, and some states have runoffs. But here's an issue that goes to the big picture cost concerns. Having these elections costs money. And at some point, either now or soon, people are going to say, not just can we afford either ammunition or ships, as you were talking about, but we've got to look at all kinds of things that we take for granted, like, oh, why don't we have runoffs? Well, that costs a fortune. And so you might want to say, well, let's maybe have the choice mechanism where, it's early in the morning, I should know this. Ranked choice. So that would solve the problem. But some people have an almost fanatical opposition to certain things.
Well, so, two questions. So here I've got the district. You're talking about House number 9 here. Daniel Biss beats Kat Abu-Jazaleh, whatever.
Yeah, I know.
But the guy gets 36,000 votes. She gets 32.
Yeah.
Somebody else gets 25. And I really don't know. My brother was asking me why I'm so curious about this. Of course, that's what brothers do. There's like seven other people here all getting stuff. One guy gets 213 votes, Mark Fredrickson, and he how many petition signatures do you have to get? Like 1,000?
Well, that can be adjusted by the state legislature. And the reason people do it is the same reason people run for president. It's ego. It maybe helps their personal business. For some of them, they've written books. And, they want to be able to say, I ran for president.
Okay.
And they don't care that it imposes burden.
Well, Andrew, I guess my question for you, since you were very articulately gave the reasons why maybe we don't have runoffs, but as we're asking ourselves every day now regarding wars and everything else, what's your line? I mean, is Daniel Biss 29.5% of the vote? So 71% of the people voted for somebody else. I mean, I don't want to have...
Well, but he won there's a system that the legislature created, and he won it. So... there you have it.
I'm not saying throw them out. I'm just saying it's reaching a point where you go, really? I mean, Kat loses to the guy by 32,000, but if Bushra Emawelia doesn't vote, she might have got all those votes and been in, or doesn't run. I mean,
right.
Well, the problem you're talking about is legitimacy, and... to go back to Honest Abe Lincoln, that many thoughtful people think is our greatest president. I certainly think so, even if I'm not one of the thoughtful people. But on the other hand, he was assassinated. In some circles that Wayne and I became acquainted with in Washington, some people in the not distant past are happy about it.
I'd even add in the present, because some of those people actually have high level jobs in the Trump administration. There's a group called the Sons of Confederate Veterans, And they have what they call camps named after Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis. But there's apparently there's a secret camp. You know, it's like many organizations. Yeah, you've got your rank and file, but then you got that secret group that meets. Apparently the name of that camp is the John Wilkes Booth Camp.
Really?
In honor of Clinton's, Lincoln's assassin.
By the way, am I close to getting invited into your guys' camp?
Absolutely. And we're marking out a trail for us to, visit the highlights and lowlights.
I have a feeling your camp headquarters would be some emporium.
Our camp would be serving adult beverages.
That's what I mean.
yes.
Not get too deep into it, but during St. Patrick's Week, I was continuing my advanced research into the quality of some of these emporiums in anticipation of your visit.
And for Andy, I think it's been a 3-day celebration, hasn't it?
Well, here in Chicago, I went on St. Patrick's night and everything was tame. Saturday is the big crazy day, and then Southside it's Sunday. But so one of the bars, the guys I was talking to last night, he does the accounting for this bar over in Halsted, and the place was absolutely mobbed, right? So he goes in and he says to the lady, "Well, how was it?" She goes, "Actually, it was pretty good." And she goes, "We made a lot of money. The place was packed. There were no fights, and no girl puked on herself." The guy goes, it doesn't get any better. No problems, and we made a lot of dough." And I'm sitting there going, there's a low bar.
All right, in that proper spirit, and particularly since you wrote me off off air how my St. Patrick's Week was going, let me say it was pretty busy with 4 major events. But here's the story behind the story. On the 18th, I guess yesterday.
yeah, you lose track, I know.
I went with a friend of mine to a place called the Irish Times, and next door to the Dubliner, which are the two big bars of a certain ethnicity within a 100-mile radius. And my friend had left his coat at one place, and I went in while he was parking his car to reconnoiter and see if I could find the coat. And I reported back to him, good news and bad news. The bad news is they couldn't find your coat. But I said, they remembered us at both places. And I said, there are hundreds of people here.
What did you do for that?
And I said, this is probably not what you want to tell your wife, but it's not exactly something necessarily to be proud of.
God.
But, I'm sharing it with you.
we've got a few minutes. We can talk about fun stuff. But after the break, I want to kind of zero in a little bit, because the market's down again here. I want to zero in a little bit on the amount of money we're spending. I mean, no matter what you do, and you could talk about, Obama did this, this guy did that, but the fact is we're draining funds here big time. And, the idea that nobody liked Iran, okay, it's not like they're good people, but to say that we had to do something 2 weeks ago when we've been trying to get us to, the Israelis have been trying to get us to do something for 40 years. Why it had happened to be that weekend, I don't know. Seemed to me that Iran, they were kind of at a low ebb, and the people, the Houthis and all these other guys, they supported. Of course, if you're a Trumper, you say, that's when you got to hit them, that kind of thing. But no matter what you do, we're not in any kind of fiscal shape here to do stuff. Now, when Hitler started his stuff, he didn't have any money, but the reason why he you know, he did all this stuff to the Jews, and the reason why he started conquering people is he basically stole all their money for his war machine. Now, here, we're pissing through $1 trillion every 100 days, and we've got the economic truth of the matter is, I mean, people can debate me on a lot of stuff, but this one you really can't. When you're running a deficit, you can only do three things. You can borrow the difference, you can tax for the difference, or you can print the difference if you're a government that can do that. I don't see them raising taxes. Borrowing, I think, is going to get a lot more expensive. Plus, he insults the hell out of the people he's trying to borrow from every day. And so that leaves printing the money. And we've had a couple of real hot inflation numbers in a row in the PPI, and actually in the CPI if you look deep enough in it. If inflation looks like it's going to pop out a little bit, plus you're borrowing more money, it looks to me like the 10 and 30-year rates, 5-year rates, 2-year rates, are really in danger of going up. Now, I hope they don't. I hope I'm wrong. But if they do, all of a sudden you have problems in housing, you have problems in stock market, and you have problems in, you know, people being able to, they're being squeezed money anyway. They're getting get squeezed anymore, gas prices, but other stuff. If they start losing their assets, that's a problem, meaning stocks or housing prices go down. So all that is a preamble. We're going to go to break here, and then we come back. You guys can kind of tie this together because I'm really worried about this. S&P futures now down 39. NASDAQ futures are 175. We just keep draining like we did all day yesterday. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Smell! You know that gasoline smell? Smells like victory.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. We're back.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe, Jimmy on the board. S&P futures now down 44. Like I said, we just keep draining. NASDAQ futures down 200. Just keep draining. We're
winning. We keep winning.
Yeah, we keep winning. Yeah, we're winning. We're doing something. DAX down 603. That's 2.5%. Ouch. FTSE down 259, 2.5%. CAC around down 153, that's a full 2%, but not quite as bad as the other two. We're in Asia, Nikkei down 1,800, that's 3.5%. That'll leave a mark. Hang Seng down 524, 2%. Shanghai down 56, that's 1.4%. So not good. This is after yesterday's Dow down 768, S&P down 91, NASDAQ down 327. And NASDAQ was worse than that, because in the morning, we were actually up $150, and we closed down 400, so that's almost a 600-point swing in the futures. That's really rare. I mean, really, really rare. Bonds up 6 basis points, 4.31 is the 10-year. So instead of a flight to quality of bonds are going down, and interest rates are going up. Not what anybody wants to see. Matter of fact, we get the 10-year, 30-year is 4.9, so pushing 5%. Oil, Up 99 cents, 97.31. But the big mover here is Brent. Brent's up $6, 113.51. As we are fairly energy neutral here. I mean, you can go back and forth, and we're exporting diesel and all that stuff. But the fact is, we're fairly energy neutral here. So our oil, West Texas Intermediate, is not up near as much as the Brent is, which is the benchmark for pretty much world oil. Gold, somehow or another, gold's getting its ass kicked, which the run to inflation, which I don't quite get, but it's on $279. It's 6%, 46.16. It was like 5,100 a week ago. Silver down $8, 69.10. Again, whack, whack, whack. The dollar is little changed. The Bank of Japan and the Fed both hold rates steady. So we'll talk about the Fed stuff when we're done with this other stuff with our guys. The euro is at 114.6. It was over 117 3 weeks ago. British pound 132.8. It was over 135. So we're talking 1.5%, 2% moves in foreign currency, which is a big deal. Crypto, which had been going up every day, now is going the other way. Got clobbered yesterday. Now it's down 1,500, under 70,000, 69,598. Jimmy, what's going on? It's hotter than hell in Arizona. They had to change day games to night games. What is going on?
Well, yes, the temperature right now in Arizona is, in Phoenix, is 69 with a high of 103. In Chicago, we are currently at 38 with a high of 47. In regards to traffic, the inbound Kennedy is now at 27 minutes. The inbound Edens is at 43, so that's building. The inbound Eisenhower is at 46. Again, we are building. Inbound Dan Ryan is 27. And today, as some people would say, the big dance officially starts. So yesterday, on the first four, Miami of Ohio beat SMU 89-79, and Prairie View A&M beat Lehigh 67-55. Now, in regards to our Bulls, they got clobbered last night by the Raptors, and I believe it wasn't even close. It wasn't. 139-109. And back to you, Chief.
And the game was not as close as the score would indicate. So there.
Okay.
It was over at halftime.
I was watching the NCAA because
so
these playing games are much better, except for the second game, the Lehigh, the SMU game versus Miami of Ohio. They were just popping threes right and left, and left.
It was like first guy over half court shoots, like in the playground.
Or first guy who gets it by the 3-point line fires it right up.
All right, guys. There is a sense, even among some of the original Trump boosters, that a lot of this has not been thought through. The expenses, the inflation attempts, the fact that we don't have any money. Like I say, don't have any money. We're deep in debt. We're borrowing from the people we're insulting. What's next here? I mean, I don't see any overall kind of plan. To me, it's, you know, it's day by day, and I think that's, whenever there's a war, I think there's some extent of that. It wasn't like Roosevelt could tell you the day that World War II was going to stop. Then again, he didn't start it. What's your sense of all this? I mean, when is the inflation rate, can this be contained to put essentially the genie back in the bottle, or the gas and the other things? It's not. Everybody thinks it's the gas that's raising the prices. It's not. It's the fact that we're pouring money into the system. But let's leave that for another day. What's your feel on and what people's perception is of going on, and how do we stop it?
I just want to add something to what you've said and the bullet points you've ticked off. You know, if we had a president who was somewhat conscious of this situation, and it might be a different story, but anyone who has seen Trump in the last few months, anyway, the cognitive decline, it's more than apparent. people who are doctors who say, look, I don't want to diagnose from afar. I need, but in this case, it's so bad. It's so extreme. This guy is rapidly
now, declining, you know what I'm supposed to say now? You know what I'm supposed to say? What about Biden?
Yeah, what about Biden? But Biden, it was not committing acts that were absolutely, without any sort of thought. I mean, yes, he was an old man, and he did flub his lines and sometimes seemed unaware of his surroundings. But in this case, we've got somebody who is absolutely convinced that the economy is doing well. America's hot. I don't know a world leader that would say that about their own country like it's some woman. He doesn't get it. And all of his advisors, like this idiot Hassett the other day, said, oh, yeah, well, consumer price rises. That's something we're not really concerned about right now. As gas here in Florida has just shot up over $4 a gallon for regular.
Well, I don't want any of that either, but maybe Andrew can speak to the... Well, you can, too. The idea that he seems to think, like all... I don't know about all, but he seems to think he has his power over life and death. If he doesn't like a place, he can kill people.
Yeah.
That I have a real problem. I mean, I even asked the Trump supporters, I go, do you have any idea how many places he's bombed this year? Well, I mean, he's bombed Iran. No, 7 countries. Do you know what the toll is in all these countries of deaths? Well, what do you mean? Why would I know that? Well, because your guy's doing it. I mean, the Chinese haven't bombed anybody that I know of.
that's right. I mean, there's two countries right now waging unthinkable wars of aggression where they don't care about civilian deaths. Well, there's three, actually. One is Russia, has been doing it for how long now against Ukraine, and the U.S. and Israel. Just carpet by, and one country that doesn't get mentioned is Lebanon. Israel is actually doing to Beirut, a huge city, what they did to Gaza, just blowing up buildings with people living in these buildings. And I got to think that people who invest in various financial operations and whatnot, and the world, I don't think the world's been this shaky in a very, very long time. And with somebody like Trump in charge, I was telling a friend of mine who's a retired Navy captain the other day, I said, I don't think we were this close to a possible accidental nuclear exchange, even during the Cold War, because even those leaders, whether you're talking LBJ or Khrushchev, Kennedy, Brezhnev, none of them were cognitively impaired. They knew what the stakes were, so they never even thought about. I don't think they ever thought about pushing a button. This guy's a different story.
Well, Andrew, how do we kind of get here to where we don't like somebody? We can bomb. He's not stopping here. He's talking about Cuba. And what did he say after the baseball game the other night? It's okay because Venezuela is going to be our 51st state. I mean, what? These utterances, everybody thinks they're kind of funny. They're not funny, I don't think. I mean, is he really thinking like that?
Well, he is, and we've got to think about the institutional problems that prevent us from recognizing the potential depth of the problem now and in the future. And here's an example. Having started my career in the newspaper business, it's highly almost necessary for news reporters to find a short quote about something and put it into their story. And that's been the tradition for since a century, let's say. But you don't really get a sense of what Trump's about unless you either look at a 400-word excerpt of what he's saying, which almost doesn't make any sense in many situations. But they can't print 400 words. And so they take a sentence or two and put headlines around it, and it sounds normal. Well, I don't think things are normal. We've got to recognize that our institutions either have to adapt or think what the implications are for us. So, for example, there are some important recent developments among his core supporters that happened just in the last few days, where some of his top national security people, including Tulsi Gabbard, who gave testimony yesterday, her prepared remarks undercut a huge part of at least one of the rationales for the war in Iran. And she omitted, it was in her prepared remarks, but she wouldn't address it verbally. And it's that her prepared remarks said that I'm paraphrasing here, but that there was no threat of nuclear danger posed by Iran to us or others at this point. And it was in there, but then it's not in there. But what does that suggest about why we have this escalating war? And it goes way beyond gas prices. It's going to be a tremendous strain on our economy or credibility worldwide. And if we think we can just print more money, suppose people in the rest of the world start looking at alternatives to the U.S. dollar, maybe China. So Politico Magazine, for example, did this, and they're part of a big Axel Springer media conglomerate, so they can afford to do a worldwide survey, and they found that China is rivaling or eclipsing in trust the United States around the world. Like, who do you trust more, China or the United States?
I think this guy in Netanyahu, I never seen anything like it.
Well, and ultimately, think of the incredible consequences if financial transactions start being done in Chinese currency instead of the good old U.S. dollar.
I hate to see that happen. I mean, if oil starts to go that way, what's the bottom line here, in the sense that, you know, I don't know that the people that were elected yesterday are going to go to Washington assuming they win, it's going to make any difference. But in terms of the cash, did you listen to Paul yesterday? In some ways,
yeah, I did listen. You know, I never thought I'd be one of my heroes as far as standing up to an autocratic tyrant president would be the chairman of the Fed. But here we are.
Well, what he said was he's not leaving unless the suit is dropped. Basically, yeah. He doesn't have to leave. This, for those that don't know, his chairmanship is up May of this year, but his actual governorship's not up till next year. And if they don't succeed in getting rid of the black lady who they're trying to get rid of, well, she's there till like 2036 or something.
Yeah.
If she's not booted out. So the new guy that they're trying to put in if Powell doesn't leave and they can't boot the lady out, there's no place for him to go. He can't get on the board. Normally, the chairman, who was the chairman, the outgoing chairman, resigns his board spot to make room for the new guy.
Right.
If there is a new guy, but he doesn't have to. So,
and Senator Tillis said he's going to block this guy Warsh if all the actions against Powell are not dropped or dismissed.
Grade me on this, professors. Powell, even though he's having this fight with Trump, because it's hard to get along with Trump no matter who you are, the fact is he's done everything the guy wanted him to do. He's poured all kinds of money into the system. Did you hear the young lady yesterday? I bet she's never invited back. You guys know more about that than me. He starts talking about, well, we've raised our estimate of inflation to 2.7, and everybody knows the numbers have come out the last 2 days. It's pushing 6 or 7 right now. I mean, what's 0.7 times 12, for God's sake, on the PPI? Mm-hmm. It's not 2.7. And well, we're going to try and work it so we can, even though we think it's going to be 2.7 this year, it's above our preferred rate of 2%. The lady says, it's been above your rate for 5 years. What are you going to do something about it or something like that? And the guy, I can't believe she said that, even though that would be one of us would ask that. She's probably banned as of this morning. But I mean, what is he talking about? And we're talking about a chairman that's been there for however many years. The guy never once has mentioned the term money supply. He keeps talking about oil shocks and this shock. His answer to this lady was, we've done everything we've done properly. Never mind the increase in the money supply. It's been a succession of COVID, oil, and other stuff that was totally beyond our comprehension and our fault. It's not our fault. That was his answer. I mean, duh.
He's obviously worried about, Trump going back at it. He did indicate, though, that part of the a good part of the inflation was caused by the tariffs. So,
which by the way, it isn't. Well, I mean, it is in the sense that it's a tax, okay, mm-hmm. And it's a tax which is the thing that has the part of the stuff. I mean, I never liked the man himself, but if you come up with a tariff. All right, this is you guys again, wing something at me from afar. If you come up with a sales tax and say we're just going to have a national sales tax, first of all, that would be like a fart in church. That dog wouldn't hunt, right? Nobody would want that. But if you did that, it's not inflationary the way we collect the CPI, because you're going to go out and you're going to look at the price of rice or gas or whatever it is, and you're going to say rice is $2 a for a big box. The tax, if we went to a 20% sales tax, and by the way, this is not a recommendation, that 40 cents goes on top of it. It is not in the CPI. It's in Andrew and Wayne and Chief's pocket, as well as all the listeners, or out of his pocket, but it's not part of the CPI. If you put a tariff in place, which this guy loves to do, I don't know where economic voodoo book he was reading, that's a good thing. Now, if you bring the rice over and you put the tariff on, the rice, instead of being $2, is $2.40. So it gets counted by the CPI, even though it's the same 40 cents. So if Trump had half a brain and he could get by, and he needed the tax, that kind of a regressive tax, and didn't want the CPI to go up, he would actually put a sales tax on, although that would be so unpopular people would understand that. Where tariffs, he can tell people, by the way, it's the French that are paying it, which is total BS. Yeah. But I'm saying the CPI actually counts tariffs in the prices where it doesn't a sales tax, right?
Right.
I mean, I this whole thing, it's almost like it's like a nightmare, and I'm going to wake up. Hopefully.
And also the state sales tax, so the price of things has gone up, and the states are getting their own windfall from that with their sales tax.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, and where's the refund on that?
I'll ask you two guys that are A students, who is the single biggest beneficiary of inflation?
I'll defer to Andy. He lives near the Federal Reserve.
Well, of course, people who have debts that are not keyed to inflation.
I'll say second. The first is the federal government. We have a graduated income tax thing, right?
Yeah.
So 5 years ago, if you were making 40 grand, you were paying 12%. Now if you're making 50, you're at the same spot you were at 40, right? But now for that extra 10, you're paying what, 25, 22?
Yeah.
And like you say, the state and the gas tax, they get, in Illinois and in most of these states, they're so crooked, they actually charge sales tax on the other taxes. So if you look at an RBOB today, now you look at where oil price is going to go, RBOB is 318, up another 8 cents. It was $1.98 4 weeks ago. So 318, that's in New York Harbor, right? Even Andrew, you're close enough. You can't go fill up there, right? So you got to drive it someplace. All right, so say it's 20 cents a gallon to get it someplace. Then you're going to drop 92 or 95 cents on top of that. How can we not be at 4.5 in a week? I mean, the math is right there.
And by the way, that's all relatively new with the war and so forth. But we're obviously focused on consumers and what we as consumers are paying more. But just a little bit of thought says, wait a second, the whole supply chain is affected here.
Yeah.
So it's not just what I do at the gas pump. It's all the trucking that goes into everything else is being hit by this stuff.
What would you guess the wholesale price of home heating oil re diesel is today?
Well, I look at my heating bill and I'm wondering how much of it was a big cold snap, and I haven't tried to break it down, but it's unbelievable.
Well, heating oil, the wholesale price of heating oil is up 21 cents today, 5%. So it's $4.40. So get that someplace, $4.50, $4.60. Throw the taxes on that. You're talking a minimum $5.50 to $6 for diesel. And when you fill up one of those big rigs, what do you put in it, 250 gallons? That's a long drink, $6 a throw.
Yeah.
And if they can't renegotiate their deals, they're going to stop driving, right? But some people, if it's a company, they're just going to have to raise some of the prices. So, I mean, heating oil, remember when diesel was cheaper than gas? Now it's a buck and a half higher. Because we're exporting diesel to Europe, right?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of these price changes, drastic as they are not necessarily factoring in the concept that solutions may not be readily at hand. I think there's a lot of people who are going to think, well, if we just bomb Iran more, they'll give up and then things will be back to normal. But here's a couple thoughts.
Isn't it nice, Andrew, not to interrupt it, when you start a war when you don't really have to, then intensifying it is a solution.
Yeah, and if they won't give up, let's send in some ground forces.
Yeah.
Where have we heard that before?
The beatings will continue until morale improves?
Exactly, but as bad as things are, if people think there's a solution, then what is it and who's going to do it? And by the way, it takes not just two sides, but multiple sides to create a solution. And when people are dying, by the way, a serious part of St. Patrick's activities is within the memory of a lot of people. There were Protestant and Catholics killing each other 35 years ago.
I remember that vividly.
People are celebrating the economic and more peaceful situation. I was at the British Embassy. I had a chance to quickly introduce myself to the British ambassador. And 35 years ago,
he's a little bit better than the last one, isn't he?
Well, I would say that about... But Well, no, I will say that, but I won't get into that. But you have animosities that people are still just trying to get over in Ireland, and we're creating vast new numbers of them with these kind of wars.
Andrew, why don't we got a few minutes? Expand on that. Why don't people understand that? I mean, the idea that this guy who blew up the synagogue in Michigan, killing innocent people is so far away from my morals, I can't go there. But when you knock off the guy's family in Lebanon,
yeah,
you're not exactly creating friends. Now, that doesn't mean he has the right to go kill people who weren't even near Lebanon. But everybody in Gaza, I read, now who the hell knows if it's true or not, everybody left in Gaza, one out of six people have a family member that's dead.
Yeah.
We're not exactly winning friends and influencing people here. I mean, the story, and I guess it's, you know, all fair in love and war, I guess, but I've heard some rumor on YouTube, and the guy could be totally all wet, said when the Israelis knocked off the leadership was meeting to consider a negotiated settlement. And that's how we got them all together. That's a little dirty before there was a war.
Yeah, and in an interest
if it's true, if it's true.
Yeah, I think it may be. There definitely the idea is that Mossad had people keeping very close track of the comings and goings and where the meetings were taking place in and around Tehran. But I remember, and I was sitting in his tent at one time in the front row listening to him talk. Muammar Gaddafi of Libya was supposedly had agreed to surrender his motorcade, left the city of Sirte, was going to an airfield where they were going to apparently fly him out under the white flag of truce. And U.S. Special Forces and the Libyan rebels intercepted the motorcade with airstrikes and ground support and wound up shooting him in the head. So people in the Middle East understand one thing, that the United States right now, and look, that was under Hillary Clinton and Secretary of State and Obama on Gaddafi, and also killing the former president of Iran, Ahmadinejad. And yeah, he said some controversial things, but here's I was actually at a dinner he hosted during the UN General Assembly session in New York. So, and two cases, two world leaders who I was a guest of are now dead. Thanks to the United States.
Well, the idea, I mean, if you look at torture, and again, we got to go in a second here, but the a lot of the people I think have somewhat philosophical minds say, obviously, the person being tortured is not having a good day, but you essentially, the torturer is wrecking himself as well. And I've talked to some people lately, and the idea is, well, we didn't really like this guy, but by the way, somebody decided they were, you know, judge, jury, and executioner. Mm. And that's not really the American way, even for other people. I mean, the Declaration of Independence does not say that only we get life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the things maybe the Mossad is getting so much better at over there is these guys are so unpopular among their own people that I think they're getting their information from Iranians. I have a feeling.
Yeah, no. Iran just arrested like 100 suspected agents for Mossad and the son of the Shah. They call him monarchist. So, yeah, there are roundups going on over there right now.
Well, you guys, you think we have enough to talk about every week?
Sure do.
I just hope we're here next week.
Where's the market going to be next week? You guys have your puts? Do you know where your puts are?
I'd rather go to the casino.
Oh, got it. Oh, by the way, what did you think of that thing I sent around that Lou sent us regarding the guy getting the death threats, the Israeli reporter, because he reported that one of the missiles actually got through the dome. It didn't hit anybody. It landed in the woods or something. But there was a bet on that none would get through, and he said one got through, and now there's death threats on the guy because they're withholding their debt money.
Yeah, on the predictive poly market. Yeah,
and it took the reporter quite an extensive effort to figure out why are all these death threats coming, and he ultimately was fortunate enough to figure out because. What was it? If the bet pays off or doesn't pay off, if it's a missile, but if it's a fragment, it's the opposite financial result. And this is so convoluted.
Yeah.
And he's getting death threats over whether he says he quotes the official people that a missile hit, as opposed to a fragment of a missile. And
well, a fragment means
rely on these reporters. To be honest and not have to worry about death from one word.
Well, the bet was if the missile made it through hull, even if it didn't kill anybody, that made a missile got through, so you lost the bet. If one of the intercepting missiles hit it and all the fragments rained down on a bunch of people, that counts as an intercepted one, then you win. It's unbelievable. Anyway, guys, have a good week. Stay out of trouble as best you can. Recover from St. Patrick's Day. SP Futures now down 50. We're just draining constantly. It's like yesterday. NASDAQ Futures down 213. Hopefully we're not this all the way to the close. That would not be good. Gold's way down. Bitcoin's way down. You name it, it's down. Hopefully it'll get better. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Well, Lawrence, we were up for a bit this morning.
This is Bob Uecker saying thanks for watching.